This episode of the Sportsman's Nation is brought to you by Outdoor Edge and their complete lineup of replaceable and fixed blade knives and game processing kits. Now, in my bag this year, I had the Razor Pro Saw Combo Kit. It comes in a very compact, handy carrying case, and one handle has the replaceable blade knife and the gutting blade. The other handle has the saw that comes with it. So I use the saw to split the pelvis, and I use the gut hook to open up the cavity and the blade to start cutting all the stuff out, right? So it makes cleaning a deer very simple, very easy, and the knife is sharp. And if you've ever had to gut a deer with a dull knife, we all know how much that sucks. So take a look at the Razor Pro Saw Combo Kit and head on over to OutdoorEdge.com and enter the discount code NATION30. That's NATION30 for 30% savings on your purchase.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ohio Huntsman Podcast. And I'm excited for y'all to hear this episode because today we had Matt Butler on. And if you're not aware, Matt Butler is the author of the book Billy Goes Hunting. We had Matt on to talk about the events that led him to writing the book. And then we continued the conversation into youth hunting, getting youth excited about hunting, getting them interested in the outdoors, some of the challenges, some of the things that we can do. So it was a really good conversation. We really enjoyed it, and I think you guys are going to enjoy it too. So before we get into that, I want to talk about our title sponsor, which is the Blue Collar Bull Sale in Somerset, Ohio. So this is your last chance for this year. The sale is going to be March 27th. So if you have cattle, if you run cattle, and you're looking for some herd improvement bulls, check out the Blue Collar Bull Sale. They've got stuff for purebred breeders. They've got stuff for commercial producers. So whatever you're looking for, they've got you covered. If you're not in a position or you're not ready to do it this year, that's okay. But I would still encourage you for the future, go on Facebook and search Blue Collar Bull Sale. Like the page, like the event. That way, next year when they have the event, you'll be notified about it. You'll know the details. And if you do want to go this year, that's also how you're going to get information. So Facebook, search for Blue Collar Bull Sale, and you'll see the event come up, and you'll get all the details on when and where. Like I said, when is March 27th, but specific times, addresses, things like that. So check them out, Blue Collar Bull Sale. These bulls are bred to work. Welcome to the Ohio Huntsman Podcast, where three brothers, Jason, Jacob, and Jeff, discuss all things hunting in Ohio. Our goal is to be your source for accurate and reliable hunting news and conservation issues in the great state of Ohio, as well as some fun and interesting conversations along the way. This is the Ohio Huntsman Podcast.
Are you listening?
All right, so excited about today's episode. We've got Matt Butler on, and this is going to, I'm excited about this conversation. So Matt, I want to thank you for taking time to come on and talk to us here for a little bit. If you could you start off sort of introducing yourself, who you are, and you know, maybe a little bit about your background, how you got into hunting, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me, Jason. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these topics and talk about hunting and to sort of spread the message, so to speak.
Sure.
I grew up in Utah, so I live on the East Coast now. In fact, I lived on the East Coast most of my adult life. But I grew up in the West, and hunting in the West is dramatically different than hunting in the East. But primarily we hunted mule deer and Rocky Mountain elk. Moose were plentiful, but that's a once in a lifetime that you have to apply for. And I think I had 20-something points and still haven't got it. But pheasants were popular, dove, ducks. Basically grew up in a town of about 600. And, you know, I was talking to a colleague of mine today talking about, like, you know, when I was about 8 years old, you probably would have to find me in the mountains with a, you know, a 12-inch knife strapped to my hip and a some sort of gun, whether it's a BB gun or a 22 or a shotgun. Sure. Rabbits. We just spent, you know, every day in the woods. That was kind of how I grew up, which sort of, I think, led me to my ultimate career path. I wound up joining the Army not long after high school. And I thoroughly loved it, and just wanted to find the limits, I guess, of my abilities. So I ended up volunteering for Special Forces, Special Operations, and spent 27 years total in the Army, and the last 20 of those years in the Special Forces or the Green Berets, which, again, sort of my childhood, my upbringing, my passions, I guess my skills even sort of contributed to me sort of succeeding in that, I guess. It was, and so that's how I ended up on the East Coast and spending most of my adult life here in the East Coast, basically between, I got a little bit of time, well, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Virginia, Kansas, Michigan were some of the highlights. You want me to just touch real briefly on how the book came about?
Well, yeah. So, I'm assuming, right, you had your time in the Army there. You then, at some point, started a family. And I have a daughter. Jacob has two kids. So, you know, we are in my daughter's five. Jacob's kids are, what, 6 and 3, Jake? Is that right?
Lily's still 5, 5 and a half, and Zach's 3.
Oh, see, I made her older than she is.
Yeah, she'll be 6 end of June. Yeah.
In June. Okay. All right. So we're in the midst of, you know, young kids, getting them excited about being outside and, you know, just all the cool stuff there is out there. But, you had some experiences that led you to writing a book. So if you could, I guess, yeah. Could you tell us sort of how that came to be?
Yeah. So it sort of piggybacked off of the military experience. When I say that we lived in Virginia, it was in the greater DC area, just inside the Virginia side of the line there.
Okay.
And I was stationed up there at the time. I guess my daughters would have been about, about 6, 8, and 10. And, you know, I know that I took it for granted that my kids were going to be outdoor enthusiasts, that my kids would love hunting and fishing. That just seemed obvious to me. I mean, how could they not? You know, I mean, right. It was generational, going back as far as I could ever remember. Everybody on both sides of my family and, both sides of both sides of my family. So I didn't really do anything deliberate or proactive. And I took them fishing. We spent plenty of time outdoors. In fact, even when we lived in Virginia, we had a house that backed up to the Occoquan River, and we spent a lot of time fishing and playing in the river. It was an assumption on my part that they would progress and like the same things I liked, and it just seemed like natural. So one day I come home from work and I find my youngest daughter in tears. She's pretty distraught. So I slow down and dig into what's going on, start asking questions. And turns out that she had experienced some bullying at school. And ultimately what come out was, you know, she went to school on that Monday, and as kids do, they're comparing notes and talking about what their family did over the weekend. And naturally my daughter offered up that she went hunting with her father. She was hunting, that I hunted. And it was not a hunting positive crowd, let's say. So so she caught, you know, caught some pretty steep, you know, for a young kid, bullying, and a sensitive child. She was a pretty sensitive kid.
Yeah.
So it just, you know, it just really upset her. The things that she brought home and wanted answers on were, you know, like why I was such a mean person, why I was slaughtering innocent animals, did I not have a heart?
Wow.
All those types of things. And I thought, well, okay, you know what I'm gonna do, like I understand all this, but I'm sure that there are people out there who are more talented than me at explaining it, so I'll go to Amazon, I'll buy a book, a child's book, I know, you know, that explains it all. And I'll just share that with her, and we'll read it a couple of times a month, and, you know, just kind of ease those principles into the conversation. Well, that book didn't exist, it turns out. I looked and I looked and I looked, and there was no such book. So I guess the light bulb went off, and I thought, huh, well, we certainly need a book like that, so maybe I'll write it. I spent a couple years writing it, and then it probably sat for another couple years, you know, being in the military, it wasn't like I had copious amounts of time to dedicate to becoming an author.
Sure, I can imagine.
Yeah, and this was post 9/11, so the war was picking up. And as a Green Beret, I was heavily engaged in the war on terror, so I put it on a shelf, basically. And then several years went by. It was about 2007, and I was stationed in Kansas, where it was strictly for the purposes of obtaining a advanced schooling for my military career. It was what we call Command and General Staff College, and so it did provide me some regularity, where I was home, you know, like class hours basically from, you know, morning till afternoon, and home in the evenings, and no deployments. So I did dedicate time to it, and that's when we published the first edition, and then second edition went out last year. So that's what it was. Excuse me. I used the title Billy Goes Hunting. I obviously sort of defaulted to a more natural male character rather than my daughter, and I don't know if that was a good or bad decision. It seemed more natural. My daughter is not upset by that. She doesn't really seek the spotlight. So, but she's fine with that. But basically, it's basically the same story. It's about a father who moved to the suburbs. He's raising his son, Billy, and Billy has a very similar experience to the one of my daughter. And so he's at the farm where his father grew up, his grandfather's farm, and he's hunting with his grandfather and asks the same questions that he's being asked about why hunting. And so his grandfather walks him through the narrative about the delicate nature of the ecosystem, about humane conservation, about the balance that the Native American forefathers kept when they were stewards, good stewards of the land, and how they lived in nature in balance, and why we use hunting and why it's a tradition and how it puts food on our tables. And so it arms the child with facts and information versus the emotional counter arguments to hunting.
Sure. And I think that's, you know, presenting it in a way that a kid can like digest and understand, I think is super important, because, you know, anybody that is, you know, really an avid outdoorsman and hunter and understands that, at least for me, I sometimes struggle with, like, how much is enough and how much is too much, you know, with trying to, like, well, the, you know, the money raised from license sale, you know, it's like sometimes that feels like too much. Man, you're too far in the weed. She's five. but you know, so I think these books like this, I'm glad that you know, like you said, you went to Amazon looking for the book. It didn't exist, and you decided to write it. So I'm thankful for you in sort of taking that on, because I think things like this are very important. We have another kids book just about, it's written by and I'm blanking on her name now, Julie something, but she's a competitive, she shoots competitive pistol matches and things, I think. Mm-hmm. And same thing, you know, she wanted a kids book to introduce her kids to the concept of firearms and guns as a tool and things like that. And didn't exist, so she wrote one, you know. And yeah. So we've gone through that book, and you know, they're not scary things. They're a tool, just like a hammer or a saw, and they need to be treated with a certain level of respect and handled safely with an adult, you know, and those sorts of concepts. So I'm excited for the book. So you said when did you published the first edition?
First edition came out in, I think it was 2008.
Okay.
Yeah, I was stationed there between 2007 and 2008, and I think it was towards the first of 2008 that we had it in print.
So. Okay.
And so, I'm familiar with that book that you talked about. Yeah, and same principle. Let's put it in terms and in a format that kids can gravitate to and understand, and give them, you know, valid information.
Yep. Yeah. So for those of you out there that are predator hunters, you'd like to go out and do coyote hunting, or I suspect probably this would even work with trapping, Mastin's Deer Sense has expanded their product line into coyote scents. So you've heard me talk in the past about their liquid scents, their scented gel crystals, and their scented candles with regards to deer. Well, now they've got liquid scents I'm on their website right now. They've got coyote urine. They've got field mouse scent. They've got wounded rabbit scented candles, field mouse scented gel crystals. So lots of cool things to check out if you're a predator hunter or coyote hunter. If that is something that's up your alley, go to mastinsdeersense.com, check them out. And as always, their prices continue to be great. So check them out, mastinsdeersense.com. What formats is the book available? Is it? I know it's you've got it available on Kindle. Is that the only platform, or?
No. You can be right now. The only place that it can be found is on Amazon, but you can get it in either a Kindle e-reader version or hardback. Almost all the sales are hardback, because most kids aren't. It's kind of, in my mind, it's like the 4 to 10 demographic. And most 4 to 10 year olds aren't interested in reading on e-reader. They want. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Okay. So how, talk to me about the publishing aspect. How, like, did you use a publisher? Did you self-publish? How did that process work for you in this sort of, maybe not so commonly socially acceptable topic?
Yeah, great question. And I'll tell you, boy, there's a good reason why probably people shy away from writing books like I originally did. I think it was just sort of some some hard-nosed dedication that I wanted to see this through that got me through. I wrote the book, like I said, back in 2002, and set it on the shelf for a while. But when I finally had it done, I reached out, standard story, send it out to dozens and dozens of publishers, and rejection letter after rejection letter. And I'm not sure what other authors' experiences have been in terms of why they were rejected. I got pretty candid feedback on why I was being rejected every time. And it always fell into one or two answers. If it was a children's book publishing company, they didn't want anything to do with a hunting topic. They would just say, no, this material is not for us. I think that they're probably more interested in, helping kids with their ABCs and their numbers and colors, which sure. is fine. So it was too controversial for the children's book authors. The hunting, so I reached out to publishers who do hunting books as well, and they just couldn't get their minds around a children's book. They just said, no, we don't do children's books. which is interesting, because I'll share another little anecdote with you, too. I sent copies of this multiple times to Gander Mountain Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's, thinking, well, this is a slam dunk. I mean, all I'm trying to do is help children gravitate towards hunting, increasing the hunting base, which ultimately increases a customer base. Like, they'll probably ask for 10,000 copies.
Sure.
Yeah, not so much. So a lot of learning curves, and I'm not trying to grind an axe against it. Just surprising, I guess, is my takeaway there, is that, they too didn't embrace it either. Ultimately, we ended up self-publishing the first one. And we sort of, before guerrilla marketing was a thing, guerrilla marketed it. Basically, I learned how to contact, basically our demographic back then, back in 2007, was mom and pop hunting stores. So the ones in competition with the Cabela's and the Gander's Mountains. If if it was whatever, let's say, Jones Hunting and Fishing Tackle Store in Mapleton, Wisconsin or something, like that was the guy I wanted to talk to. And so I would, I would email them and usually have a phone call conversation, and they would be enthusiastic. And we sold them ultimately kind of at a wholesale. Small margin. I think we were selling them $5. I think it cost us $3 to print, and selling them at about $5. And I think most people retail them at $10. We still retail at $10, actually. So, yep.
Okay. So, I guess that sort of leads us into a bigger conversation on, just getting youth and kids excited, getting them excited and maybe more importantly, keeping them excited about the outdoors and hunting. Because I guess maybe a story to sort of kick that off, I'm a new parent. I've got one kid, she's 5, and I have been surprised by how not squeamish she is about things, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've taken her tracking deer, we walk up on a dead deer, she's seen a deer gutted, we go fishing, we kill fish, skin them or scale them, gut them, turn them into food. And none of that, it's almost like that's a learned thing that, ooh, that's gross. At some point people learn that, like, ooh, Is that, do you get stories about that, or did you experience the same thing with your kids?
Well, actually, that's a great, that's just such a great comment. And you actually took the words right out of my mouth with it being a learned behavior. It is, in fact, a learned behavior. If you look at, you know, emerging world populations and people who still hunt and gather quite a bit of their food sources in different continents, the idea of that process being squeamish, that would be so foreign to them. It's sort of a Western thing where we've moved, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, moved so far away from that, you know, as a civilization, most of us have moved so far away from that's just sort of unnatural to a lot of people. So writing this book sort of opened my eyes to a much bigger problem, and it's the problem that you're talking about. I'm not sure how many people in your listening audience are aware or know, but you know, right now the government figures suggest that the hunting demographics, about 33% of all hunters are baby boomers, which ultimately means probably about 10 more years of hunting. And then, so you could probably argue by 2030, unless something drastic happens, will be 60 to 65% of hunters of what we have now. So we'll probably go from about 18 million down to closer to 12 million hunters in the next 10 years. And to me, like when I first started, you know, like I said, when I first wrote this, I would go to trade, you know, or not trade shows, but like the hunting expos, and I'd speak at like Safari Club or Boone and Crockett meetings and things like that. And that's what I learned. I started to really see how in jeopardy the hunting tradition is. And so it became more of a, you know, there's nothing about the book that it's not my full-time job. It's not even really a great source of income. It's just, it's more of a passion project where I'm doing what I can to try to get the word out, to try to spread this message that we actually have quite a bit of work to do if we want to, in my opinion, if we want hunting to remain a viable pastime. I sort of get chills and worry about, if you think about it, like I think right now, the number that I gave out, there's about 18 million. So that's a pretty small minority in our society. And if it drops another 30%, like I begin to worry that maybe, you know, politicians, we won't be heard.
Right.
And hunting as we know it, could be jeopardized politically. So, I'm always trying to encourage people to hunt. And yes, I agree with you. I think that the most natural way, and even though I hadn't really taught my daughters how to confront an anti-hunter, they all hunted. And they're all, I wouldn't say they're all hunters. Only two of them are married, and one is definitely married into a hunting family. And as I guess, you know, as much as possible, I see that tradition continuing. But the way that I did that or do it is, like you say, just in a very natural way. Like this is the natural order of our family. This is how we put food on the table. This is how we participate in conservation. And having those conversations, I always tell people, I actually have I'm going to give a little plug for my Instagram here. You can find me on Facebook or Instagram under the same title, Billy Goes Hunting. And I've been sharing hunting facts, but if you go back and look at all my past posts 6 months ago or last part of 2020, I was posting how to share hunting with your children. And okay. And one of the parts that I really enjoyed about that is, you know, as parents, keeping in mind that when a child has questions, that's a green light that there's an interest in what, you know. And so when you're doing those things and you're having those questions, you know, I mean, and I'm not trying to be critical here. I was a parent for a long time myself, and there's times when you get to your end of your rope, and you know, the answer is because I said so, right? Right. You're tired of questions, but in this context, I would encourage that's a great time to that's when your ears should perk up and your eyes light up and be like, okay. My kid's asking questions about hunting or deer or fish, and let's tease those questions out and let them work through this, because, and that's why they're asking, because they have questions and they're interested. So,
okay. So do you know, or are you familiar with any stats, I guess, on like recruitment rates of youth? You know, what youth or new hunters coming in are replacing the boomers that are aging out? Like, what's that ratio look like?
I am familiar with them, and sadly they're not great. There's a number of factors that are at play, right? So, we're becoming a less and less rural, society. You know, just like in my book, right? Like, it's ironic that I sort of wrote it very accurately 14 years ago, not really fully understanding the problem that was in front of us. But in the story, Billy's father moves to the suburbs, you know, and so the farm was a place that Billy visited. You know, he visited his grandparents often, but it was sort of a place that he went, you know, it wasn't his home. And, right. And that's actually very accurate. Like, you know, we're becoming more and more of a suburban civilization, or even urban, population's growing, and it's harder and harder for people to earn a living in, you know, and I'm very familiar with it. I grew up in like I said, in a town of 600. And so, it becomes, harder and harder to eke out a living there, farming. And, so as that happens, so that's one thing, is that the number of people who sort of live off the land, both farming and hunting, is dwindling. Another aspect of it, actually is, parents raising children in single family homes, or the number of children being raised in a single family home. That's having an impact on it as well. And ironically, it's also one of the studies would suggest one of the largest potential demographics to increase hunting. Right now, women in a whole are the leading demographic growing within hunting. They're growing faster than men are. They're growing faster than youth. They're growing faster than however, what other way you want to slice the demographics. And in my discussions with single moms about the topic, I've had several single moms at these events talk to me about, you know, like, I was never raised with it, but I now am a mother to a 10-year-old boy. His father's not in the picture. What have I got to do? Where do I start? So there's that dimension to the problem as well. And then I guess the last, and so I guess what I'm trying to say is, overall, the numbers stand to drop by 30 to 33% over the next 10 years. I think that the urban and suburban, migration of families and the single leaves it so that we're kind of at parity. We're not really gaining the hunters that we would have, you know, 20, 30 years ago. That's sort of like a 1-to-1 ratio where we're sort of losing as many as we gain. And yeah, so I'm not sure if I answered that question. I sort of went off track a little.
No, that was good. I want to pause here briefly and talk about our sponsor, Monster Whitetail Grub. So Monster Whitetail Grub is an Ohio deer feed company. And what that means is they try to source everything from Ohio. So when you buy their product, you're also helping the Ohio economy. They make a great product. Their signature Monster Whitetail Grub feed is good stuff. We've had a lot of good success with it. I'm talking deer digging holes in the ground to try to get to the last of this stuff. It's got mineral mixed in, which I think is why the deer keep coming back, and you've got flavor enhancers. So they offer apple, they offer acorn, they offer blackberry, persimmon, pear, peanut butter, cherry. So it turns regular feed into a long-range attractant. So I really encourage you guys, if you're using feed or if you're using corn, give Monster Whitetail Grub a try and see what you think. Go to ohiohuntsman.com/sponsors and there's a link there to their website and you can get in touch with them and order their stuff. So I guess with another topic I'd kind of like to pick your brain on is, have you seen, because we've read and heard things that the pandemic and, you know, not being able to go to the grocery store and buy meat has, you know, driven a lot of people to sourcing their own protein. I know we've got a few chickens here and I was on their website today and the hatchery that we use for our chickens, their day-old chicks are booked through, like, mm-hmm. out through mid-May this year, because I think, you know, part of that is people are, you know, that scared people, that freaked people out. And so they're like, we've got to do something. So have you seen or, you know, can you sort of collaborate or collaborate's not the right word, but speak to some of those articles, yeah. You know, are there maybe corroborate those stories on people sort of seeking out hunting now? Is it new people or maybe more so people getting back into hunting that used to hunt?
Yeah. So I have, and I'm completely familiar with those same trends. I'm kind of concerned, and I think that this is has remains to be seen. I think we all can agree that we hope that the pandemic and some of the other sort of social dilemmas that we're facing right now sort of pass us by, and we can kind of get back to, you know, what our lives were, you know, 14 months ago. But absolutely, last year and continuing on till the present, there's been a serious uptick, like you say, you know, people wanting to learn, take up backyard, you know, chickens and learning how to dress game. And I've had, actually, that's been one of the biggest topics that I've, talk to people about as an author is people asking me, okay, I'm again that single mother, I'm completely new, how do I learn how to field dress a deer other than YouTube? So 100% agree with your observation. Again, my concern, my worry is that if, as it pertains to growing and saving hunting as a way of life, my concern is that if, let's say, you know, everybody's vaccinated, we return to normal, restrictions are off, masks are a thing of the past, I worry that the same thing will happen with backyard chickens and hunting. But you are right, the hunting numbers and permits and all those did take a tick up in 2020 because of that. I'll also say this, though. I mentioned that women are the fastest growing demographic in hunting, but they are not the largest potential demographic for hunting growth. Ironically, I'm going to sort of caveat or segue into this because of your comment about sourcing protein. But believe it or not, the demographic that actually holds the largest potential for growth in hunting is millennials. And when I tell people that, they nearly roll their eyes and chuckle at me. yeah, exactly. Like once you process it, once you hear it and then process it, you're sort of, your first instinct is like, you mean that kid with the skinny jeans and the man bun that's fixing my latte at Starbucks? That dude? but here's why, right? For most of us who are, you know, maybe Gen X or Gen Y, and we think of millennials, that, you know, there's a bit of a disconnect there for us as hunters. But here's the interesting thing. When you think of protein sourced through hunting, we're talking about lean, organic, non-GMO, and right. And guess what all those kids want and seek in their diets. So it turns out that is actually, according to the experts, that is the demographic that holds the largest potential for growth. Not growing yet, but if we could unlock it, which is my, you know, my invitation to us as hunters. Now, if I may, I'll elaborate on that point too. That sadly, when I have this conversation with people my age, and I'm 50, I'll be 52 this summer, 52 and older. Sadly, what I get a lot is, well, good. You know, the fewer the hunters, the better. You know, there's already too many people on public land, and, you know, more big bucks for me. And yeah. And I think that's a really narrow, short-sighted view of the problem. Because, you know, again, without a really healthy population of hunters and a really active voice in the political process, and, you know, paying, I mean, here's the number one that, like, I think you already alluded to it, but it's not a great topic for talking with your 5-year-old daughter, but the number one statistic is the billions of dollars that hunters pump into conservation. So if those numbers dwindle and go away, then what will we, you know, where will conservation end up? So it sort of saddens me when colleagues or peer hunters, you know, sort of cheer the demise of the sport. So in any case, my invitation to other hunters when speaking to or talking about millennials as potential hunters is, yeah, like, you're right. You probably won't get me to approach my barista at Starbucks and invite him to go hunting with me. Like that's, yeah, that's not happening. But I bet you know a millennial in your family. Maybe that right. kid that did move to the urban area or suburban area, who, you know, he's your sister's boy, and he's, you know, he's a gamer. He's whatever. He's not. You know, he's never expressed any interest in that. That, I mean, you have a relationship with him because he's family. And so it would be natural, it'll be easier and more natural to approach him and invite him. And then I always try to encourage people when doing that, try not to take those new hunters on, you know, the day that, you know, it's 10 below, there's a driving storm, you know that you're going to see that trophy buck, and, you know, you're going to be out at your tree stand at 5 a.m. That's probably not the way to do it.
We call that a suffer fest.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Break them in gentle is always my advice. It's kind of the same with kids. as it is with the, you know, with the new hunter. Even sometimes for new hunters, it's a huge victory for them just to see a deer, for them to, you know, just to get out in the woods and experience that, or a turkey, and say, see, it's, you know, there's no real mystery, you know, it's not a great mystery. We can figure this out. We can do this. We can introduce you, you know, and go from there. And then the other thing is, it's going to take time. It's not a one-time orientation and a one-day hunt and you have a hunter. You're probably going to mentor that person, they say, somewhere in the space of about 3 years to really get it to stick.
So what advice, because this is one place I struggle with introducing new people. What advice do you have on, like, gearing somebody up? To what level do you say, like, you need to go out and buy a bunch of camo, a bunch of warm clothes, waterproof boot, like, what guide us on that? What do you usually tell people, or what have you seen that is enough to where they can have a good experience, but not so much that they're like, oh geez, I didn't know I was going to have to go out and spend $800 on gear to try this.
No, great question. And another question that I get a lot, and here's what I tell people, and here's also what I do. I don't tell them to spend any money. Actually, I tell them, listen, man, all you got to do is you just got to show up or be awake when I show up to pick you up. you know, and between now and then, come over to the house. You know, I've put on, believe it or not, I've put on some weight since I was 20. So, so there's, you know, there's probably some large, X or large, maybe some double X. I don't know, depending on, you know, when I was, what weight I was, but I have a variety of clothes. I think most of us probably hoard, you know, our hunting clothes. We always are in that mindset of, well, you know, I'm going to need this someday just in case.
Yeah.
And it may not be top of the line gear, but between, I would be willing to bet, you know, a dollar or two that between you and another relative or some of your close friends, that you could probably safely outfit that person for nearly every circumstance, you know, in a fairly, like I said, not in extreme conditions, but in your fairly common conditions. And then it goes the same for a weapon. I don't ever encourage those that I'm introducing to hunting to buy a weapon for a number of reasons. One, it's expensive. Number two, to me, a weapon is a very personal choice. I helped a friend buy a handgun over Christmas for self-defense, and we went to the range, and one of those ranges where you could shoot, you could pay a fee, and then you could shoot any weapon they had on the wall.
Sure,
and
yeah.
I said, listen, the number one thing about having a weapon for self-defense is being very proficient with it. Proficiency comes through practice. If you hold a gun that hurts your hand or is uncomfortable or painful, you're not going to practice. You'll never become proficient, and it was a waste of your time and money. So shoot until you found one that you just really like the feel of and you would be excited to go and shoot again. And so, you know, that's a lot to get through again with, you know, someone for a first hunt. So again, I'm like, you know, if it were a deer, for example, you know, a deer hunt, I would probably want them to hunt with a rifle versus archery at first, obviously for obvious reasons. And then I would loan them one of mine and take them to the range and just get them to a proficiency level for that first hunt. I would equip them and outfit them with clothes that I could assemble through friends and family and just help them to have sort of a successful hunt. And that might even mean hunting in evenings, not, you know, not those early mornings, and trying to give them a really, really positive first step into it. I'll even go as far as to say that I think that sort of extends not just through to those steps, but through the harvest, the butchering, and even the preparing of the meal. There's a lot of what I would call institutional knowledge that we hold as lifetime hunters who've grown up in hunting families, that just sort of, I think you don't realize how much you know, and it just, you know,
Sure, yeah.
And so, you know, like talking to them about, you know, how to dress a deer so that the glands don't spill onto the meat and ruin and spoil the meat, or, yeah, you know, not dragging the deer so much so that it bruises the meat, and how to prepare it, you know, which parts are, you know, what you're going to want to do with the loins versus what you're going to want to do with the hams and things like that. So that they get the most satisfaction out of that, for sure.
You know, that's a good point there. That's one I hadn't really thought of. You know, I had gone up to the point of like, okay, here you go, you know, here's a deer or whatever, but you're right. There's different cuts of meat are more well suited for different types of preparation. Mm-hmm. And if they've only ever cooked with beef, you know, cooking, like you said, a very lean, clean meat it needs to be handled differently. It needs to be cooked differently. Yeah.
Yeah, completely. Could you imagine the pain you'd feel if they said, yeah, and there are these two big, large strips of meat on the back that I cut off and ground into burger?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're like, oh, yeah. No.
Yeah.
So there's a, you know, that's how I say there's a lot that goes into it. Again, it's probably a 3-year process at a minimum. And I also think, too, another one of the more successful tips that I like to give people too is, you know, I think that you could safely say that the vast majority of hunters are focused like deer is the number one, right? Like the white-tailed deer, that's kind of the king of the hunting community, at least by numbers. And that's great. And I'm certainly a fan of large white-tailed deer as much as the next guy. But I also think that there's a lot of other game opportunities that give new hunters exposure to at a lower bar and at a more frequent rate, right? Like,
right,
it's so much easier to go out and go squirrel hunting, you know, and we can walk and we can kind of carry on a conversation. It's more social, or with rabbits. Rabbits are one of the funnest hunts because, you know, you don't have to be quiet. You're letting the dogs, if you're hunting with dogs, you're letting dogs do work. You don't have to be up, you know, in your tree stand at 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. or whatever early light is. So there's ways to lower that bar too. I love pheasants. Pheasants are a great one. If you can get somebody who has the ability to shoot, a moving bird, squirrels, rabbits. And then the other part of that too is you can get so many more touches, right? Like depending on what state and what laws you have, you might be able to, you know, you might be able to squirrel hunt for months. You might be able to rabbit hunt for months. And so you have a greater opportunity to get them out into the field over the course of the year, not just, you know, sort of concentrated in that, you know, I don't know, September through November for most of us. On whitetail deer. Yeah.
All right. So Jake, Jeff, I've done a lot of talking. What questions or comments do you guys have for Matt?
The only question I had was just a simple question about the book. Roughly how many copies have you sold?
Wow, that is a good question. Couple thousand copies in the first edition. Like I said, I was sort of at a pause in my career, if you will, an academic pause, which was nice, you know, much needed because of the war on terror. But right after I left that, it was right back into the fire pan. And to be honest with you, it went on the back burner pretty heavy right then. It wasn't until I retired in 2017 that it became a priority for me again. And probably no more than that in the past couple of years as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. No, not a million dollars. Kind of
interested. Yeah.
I wish I'd sold a million copies. But nope, a couple thousand.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, hopefully we can sell a few more for you after, you know, people listen to this. I know I'll be going and picking up a copy. So, Jake, you got anything?
Kind of just in terms of along the lines of, I guess, hunter retention or getting new people into hunting. What, you know, like Jason touched on, kind of, I struggle from the same thing of like, I get in the weeds too far, or like, because I'm a family, you know, I have a growing family, two young kids, like time is very valuable to me. So I don't get that much time to hunt on my own. Mm-hmm. So the struggle I have is like, I don't, as funny as it sounds, like I don't want to waste one of my hunts mm-hmm. teaching someone else how to hunt, because I just don't get that many chances. So I guess what advice or tips do you have maybe along those lines, like to try and change the mindset? Because I know, like, it's a struggle I have. I know it's not a waste, obviously, because we need hunters and we need to recruit these people. But it's just, I struggle with finding the time to go on what I would consider extra hunts mm-hmm. because I use all my time that I have with work and family and whatever just to fill my own freezer.
Jake, are you talking about you're taking your own kids or taking other, like introducing other people outside of your own kids?
Yeah, like adult onset, like I don't have an example exactly, but like a colleague from work, or whatever, like
your
my
barista.
Kids. Yeah. My barista. My kid, like it's that family time, so I can rationalize that more.
Yeah, so that's also a great question. I would tell you that, I guess I'll give you a couple suggestions, and I will tie it into the children, to the children thing. I think that for me, again, I sort of had like two categories of hunts. There were hunts when, you know, when I was getting good sign, good trail camera footage, good indicators, when like, okay, like, you know, dad needs to be alone. Dad's going out early. Dad's applying every tactic he has, and I'm chasing, you know, a big buck. And those,
cashing in my chips on this one.
Yep. Those I would never have used or thought to use as one of those trips. And then there were times where, no, this is a freezer hunt. Like, you know, it's getting late in the season. I'll even, you know, I'm going to harvest a doe. I'm going to harvest anything I see, you know, I can see, because, you know, we want the meat. And on those, I'm more than happy to take my children, right? Like, even when they were, you know, really young, like I said, you know, 6, 8, 10, then later through the years, and taking my daughters out and, you know, sitting. I would generally put them, use ground blinds in those hunts. I love taking them turkey hunting. Same thing, because a ground blind, I think, you know, gives us a good, it's safe, not in a tree stand. You know, we can be together, we can kind of whisper, all that sort of stuff. So I kind of had two different categories of hunts is the first thing. The other thing I'll say is, again, I don't want to be, you know, necessarily redundant or not give you a good answer to your question, but, what I'll say is that, I'll just reinforce the idea that a great way to introduce new hunters is by lowering that bar and perhaps going rabbit hunting or squirrel hunting or bird hunting, because it's so much easier. And those, I would imagine that you could probably make some more time for those, because it's at a different part of the year than when you're so focused on larger animals. But again, I can appreciate what it's like to have a young family and be being stretched in so many different directions. The other, I guess, advantage to hunting at a different time of the year or different species, different game, is those skill sets that they learn will still transfer, right? Like there's still value in, you know, being able to read sign, being able to understand gun safety, being able to read a map, scent control, noise control, all those things. So it just might be a different type of hunt, I guess is what I'm saying.
Sure. Okay. So I guess my next question is, what's next for you? Do you have any other books in the works, or you got something else coming down the pipe, or?
No, actually, the reason I know that book that you mentioned in the beginning is because the same way that I sort of get concerned about hunting, I feel the same sort of concerns about gun rights and the Second Amendment. And so I had the idea about a year or so ago that, oh, you know what? We need to follow it up with a sequel, Billy's First Rifle. And I did my research to see what was out there, and I'm like, oh, like she's already knocking it out of the park. Like I don't need to compete with that, not because like I can't or anything, just because like, no, like these are passion projects. And so it's like, now we got a better advocate than, you know, with her being a competition shooter than I could ever probably do. So, sure. No real projects on the horizon. Well, that's not true. I will say that I'm hoping that, the pandemic will, ease up soon so that we can get back to hunting expos and whatnot, because I'd like to get back out on the road talking to people about this a little bit more. And sure. I would really, it does cross my mind, like I would love to create a nonprofit. I haven't figured out how to do it yet. I mean, not the paperwork, that I can figure out, but I mean like the best way of going about it. I would love to create a nonprofit for single family or single, yeah, children being raised in a single parent home, where, you know, they would like to get their children introduced to hunting, something where a mother would apply to the nonprofit, and then we would have people who've been through background checks and whatnot, who would get, you know, the children to get matched up with a mentor hunter, and you know, a youth would be able to go out, go hunting. And, you know, imagine how that would feel for like a 14-year-old boy who, you know, sees his mother working her fingers to the bone, and he's able to, you know, go out and harvest a deer and bring home, you know, 50, 70 pounds of protein and put it in the freezer. That's something I would like to do. I just kind of need to figure it out, but.
Okay. Well, you know, you start to have some movement on that and you want to come back on and talk about that, for definitely would like to have you come back on and talk some more about that. I like that idea. When it kind of gave me the tingles when you were sort of playing that scenario out. So I hope something comes of that.
Thanks. I think it's a worthwhile idea. I've seen that firsthand. I've seen, you know, single mothers and single parents struggle. And I think that there's a need there, both for the family and both for hunting. And I think that it could be a win-win.
Awesome. Well, that's probably a good place to end it. The last thing I always ask people is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wish I would have, or anything that we didn't cover that you think we should have?
No. Well, you could have asked me what my next hunts are. I'm excited. And only
what
say that
on,
because
what do you got in the books?
Yeah, I'm real excited. That's the only reason I'm sort of teasing that one out. And that's because I have a good friend that I served with and in special forces, and we're having a reunion hunt this September in Alaska for Yukon moose and black bear. And
oh wow!
Super excited about getting up there and trying that out. So hopefully everything will go.
Yeah. Do you have experience up there? You've been up there before, or is this going to be the first time?
I do have experience fishing up there. Ironically, the daughter that got bullied, she's not much of a hunter, but she is an avid fisherwoman. Okay. And, it never fails that she outfishes me. So I took her. I took her to Kenai, Alaska, and she caught a 50. I think it was 55-pound king salmon. Wow. Yeah. So I've been there, but not hunting. This will be my first hunt in Alaska.
Awesome. Well, good luck with that. Hopefully that, if anything, it'll certainly be a memorable hunt.
Yes, it will. Yep.
So, all right. Well, again, I want to thank you for coming on and talking with us. For the listeners, go check Matt's book out, Billy Goes Hunting. As he said in the beginning, it's available on Amazon. And with that, I think that's it. So thanks.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. That's it for this week. Again, I want to thank Matt for coming on and talking to us. Go to Amazon, check out his book. The physical copy is $9.99. The Kindle edition is $2.99. So super cheap and tells a good story that isn't being told in most other or any other kids' books that I'm aware of. So go support Matt. I would appreciate that. And while you're at it, give this episode a like and make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. That way you automatically get notified every time there's a new episode and you don't miss any of this good content. So with that, I'll let everybody get back to their week. And we'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.